Amelia Earhart was in her days, in the 1930s, was the most famous woman in the world. She was given awards and accolades from all the heads of the European states, and from the United States she was given medals and National Geographic Awards. She was quite the headline in her day.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I'm not so sure I would have gotten in that. I would have flown in that airplane with Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, I would have taken the bus.
I would have taken the bus, I'll say. She really had no idea of the danger she was facing. It's not much of a secret in the Marshall Islands that Amelia Earhart crashed on Mille Atoll. When it came time to land on the island of Saipan, it is believed that the Marine Corps found the grave of Amelia Earhart and had it exhumed and the body sent back to Washington.
What? That's crazy.
This is such a complicated... You want me to go into the more details? I can tell you more details about this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7 coming at you with an installment of the program that is 7 long years in the making as BOA Audio finally examines the infamous Amelia Earhart disappearance mystery with our guest Carol Lynn Dow, author of the book, The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart. As you'll hear when the conversation gets rolling, this is a topic I've wanted to cover on the program for years, and was absolutely thrilled to get Carol on the program to delve into this mystery in depth. As such, it is a comprehensive conversation, my friends. Over the course of the next 2 hours, we will discuss Amelia Earhart's rise to fame and her feats as an aviatrix, her attempt to fly around the world and the various ways in which her journey was doomed, and what ultimately may have become of the legendary pilot. We'll look at all the various theories surrounding Amelia Earhart's fate and dig into Carol's contention that the famed aviatrix crashed in the Marshall Islands, was captured by the Japanese, and executed as a prisoner of war. Along the way, we'll look at Amelia Earhart conspiracy theories and the hard science of early aviation, as well as the usual side roads and tangents familiar to listeners of the program. Altogether, it is a long overdue episode which delves into one of the world's most enduring and intriguing mysteries as we search for Amelia Earhart with Carol Lynn Dow. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Carol Lynn Dow, please allow me to provide you with a little background on her. Carol Lynn Dow, fresh out of college, started out life as a publisher and editor of a stock market magazine called The Dow Digest. After a successful career, Dow Digest was sold to a Kansas City Investors. Several years later, it was sold to Financial World, a New York City stock market magazine, which, shortly thereafter, went out of business. When Carol had the magazine, Dow Digest developed a circulation that reached 36,000 paid and had quite a name and reputation on Wall Street. Two of the terms which the magazine introduced were economic indicators and the area of relative strength. After the magazine was sold, Carol moved to Dallas, Texas, became a business broker, and developed a second career in mergers and acquisitions. Shortly thereafter, she took early retirement, sold her airplane, and pursued a dream she has always had, writing books and movies. To add more fuel to her current work, she met Muriel Earhart Morrissey, Amelia Earhart's sister, Pidge, on a trip to Boston, and they became fast friends. Her website is www.lostflight.net, pretty simple, all one word, lostflight.net. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 24th, 2013, Carol Lynn Dow, talking about the Amelia Earhart disappearance mystery on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. And here we are coming up upon the very end of this season. We are very close to the season finale. And it is thrilling for me today to finally get to a topic that I have wanted to discuss on this program for 7 long years. And that is one of the great mysteries of the 20th century. Really one of the great mysteries in American history, if not the world. Something that has captivated so many people for 75, 76 years now. And that is, of course, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. I have been trying to find various guests on this topic for years and years and years, and finally, I have found Carol Lynn Dow. And she is the author of the book, The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart, which is also something that she's trying to turn into a movie, and you can find out more about her whole milieu of work at AmeliaEarhartMovie.com. This topic is definitely one that has fascinated me for years. As many people know, I kind of grew up in the unsolved mysteries era of esoterica, and this one really is one of the tent poles of the entire paranormal field here for a lot of us who have looked at these mysteries for a very long time. So I'm very excited to have her on the program. Carol, welcome to BOA Audio. I'm just thrilled to be digging into this topic with you.
Right, I appreciate your asking me to talk about Amelia Earhart because there's been recent developments on the mystery and solving the mystery, and we think we might have our hands on the final answers, but of course time will only prove it's true. There has been recently, just this year, files from Fred Gerner, who was the CBS radio commentator from San Francisco, who wrote the book, the first book actually on Amelia Earhart's disappearance. And the name of the book was The Search for Amelia Earhart. His files just recently opened in Fredericksburg, Texas at the National Museum of the Pacific War. I went down there and spent about 3 days looking through his file papers, and I came back quite amazed. There's quite a few things there to talk about. Another thing that has happened is we were sponsors of a trip that Dick Spink made to the Marshall Islands, and in particular Milly Atoll, and he brought back what we think is an artifact off of Amelia Earhart's airplane. It's actually an inspection plate off the engine cowling or the leading edges of the wing on Earhart's plane. And right now we are in the process of the proving stage that this came from Earhart's plane. And as soon as we have that authenticated, which we believe we will, then we will issue a press release on this, and the whole world will know about that Amelia Earhart crashed in the Marshall Islands. Milly Atoll is the location.
Wow.
So how's that for an opener?
I was just going to say, wow, you don't waste any time, Carol. I'm already excited here. Well, we generally, we're going to get back to all that stuff in quite some time. So let's first find out a little bit about Carol Lynn Dow. You know, who are you? How did you find out? Well, obviously, you know, everybody knows about the Amelia Earhart story, but how did you become captivated by this story and decide to look into it and, you know, spend all this time researching this famous disappearance?
Well, I was originally a magazine publisher. My father was a stockbroker, and I grew up on the Wall Street Journal, and when I graduated from college, I started a magazine called the Dow Digest, and it was a stock market magazine, and we got it up to about 36,000 paid, and I sold it. And after that, I matriculated to California because I was interested in the movie industry. And about a year later, I moved to Dallas, Texas, because that was the hot spot in the whole United States for growing cities. So when I wound up in Dallas, because of my background, stock market background, I became a business broker dealing in mergers and acquisitions, which is a form of commercial real estate. I sold the magazine way back in 1980-something. I can't remember the dates. And I was looking for something to do. And I got interested in the life of Amelia Earhart, mainly because I had an airplane. I was very successful as in commercial real estate, and I bought a Beechcraft Bonanza VTOL, a 1960 airplane. How about that? An old one, but airplanes are not judged by their age, they're judged by the time on the airframe. And Bonanza is good for 10,000 hours, and when I bought that airplane, it only had 4,500 hours on the airframe, so it wasn't even halfway depleted, so to speak. I sold the airplane, and afterwards I made a trip to Boston, a business trip to Boston, where I met Amelia Earhart's sister, Muriel. And Muriel and I became fast friends, and naturally I became intrigued with the idea of a movie about Amelia Earhart and the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. That's how it all started.
Interesting, interesting.
Yeah, I bumped into Allied Artists on the internet. We had a head-on collision, and we tried to make a movie out of the story. But it's really tough these days to raise $25 or $30 million to make a movie. It's kind of a lifetime adventure.
Yeah.
And it happens to some people. Some people it doesn't happen to. But we haven't given up on the prospect. In fact, right now the prospects are better than ever because we have two documentaries, actually, three episodes coming out on Amelia Earhart that Felix Gerard at Allied Artists will attempt to have aired on stations like the Discovery Channel, National Geographic Channel, the History Channel. They're all possibilities for airing the documentaries. We think that once the documentaries get aired, that it's going to improve our chances of getting the movie made by leaps and bounds.
Well, absolutely, yeah. That'll definitely generate a lot of interest.
Right, because the interest will be there and we can get our story out.
Now, I got to ask you, Carol, you're talking about, you know, how your family was in Wall Street. Are you related to the Dow of Wall Street fame?
No relation.
Oh, okay.
No relation. The name is the same. Actually, the name is Dove, D-O-V. Davinsky, Soviet Union. And I dropped the Insky.
Hmm.
Because I didn't, I was being called, they thought I was from Poland, and I'm not from Poland, I'm from Russia. And so I used Dove, and Dove didn't work too good, so I used Dow, and when the stock market magazine came along, it was a perfect way, I thought, to protect the name so I could use the name on the magazine. The name of the magazine was Dow Digest. So that was a natural. It turned out to be a good move.
I guess so, yeah. It was very fortuitous.
Yeah.
All right, so let's, I want to get later on into this friendship you have with Muriel, because I'm definitely interested in what she thinks happened to her sister. But for the people who, you know, have been living under a rock, or let's face it, some of the younger listeners, they probably only know about this tangentially, because the Amelia Earhart story was huge for a very long time, and it seems like in the last 15, 20 years it's moved off to the periphery of the paranormal, if you will. You know, give us a thumbnail of who was Amelia Earhart and what happened and how massive a star she was. Because a lot of people don't recall, you know, they don't know that, if you will. They don't realize that she was this international celebrity who disappeared. It wasn't just an airline pilot. So I guess tell the story of Amelia Earhart and which culminated in her disappearance, and then we'll get into the theories behind what became of her.
Okay, Amelia Earhart was in her days, in the 1930s, she was the most famous woman in the world. She was an aviator who was completely fearless, and she set world records wherever she flew her airplane. Her most notable accomplishment was flying solo across the Atlantic in the footsteps of Charles Lindbergh. She was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic and the first woman to fly even as a passenger across the Atlantic in the flight of the Friendship. She was given awards and accolades from all the heads of the European states, and from the United States she was given medals and National Geographic Awards. She was quite the headline in her day. And when she disappeared at Howland Island, it was quite a letdown, but nonetheless, she is gone, and there's no way we can bring her back. If she was living today, she would be over 100 years old, so it was just a question of time, but it was really a tremendous loss. And she was probably the most famous of all the women pilots that ever flew in the skies and set world records from Hawaii to Oakland, California, from Mexico City nonstop to New Jersey, nonstop across the Atlantic.
Just those amazing,
were the three,
yeah.
Right, those were the three most impressive. And she was married to George Putnam, who was the publisher of G.P. Putnam & Sons book publishers. So he was quite a publicist. I'm not sure if I can pronounce that correctly.
That, you got it, you got it.
Yeah, publicist. And he, of course, supported her in all of her adventures. However, the most expensive flight that she undertook was the world flight around the world.
Right, right.
Which ended in disaster at Howland Island.
Right. That was the culmination of her various exploits, was to do the around the world flight, which, now at that time had, you know, it's almost a completely different, it is a completely different world. You know, people fly around the world all the time. The satellites go around the earth in about 15 minutes. So it's almost impossible to conceive of how perilous and difficult this journey was, correct? I mean, how many people had even flown around the world before she tried it?
Well, flying around the world at the equator was quite a problem because that was the widest part of the globe. So the journey took like 2 months just to get to Howland Island. Well, she never arrived at Howland Island. She to get to Ley, New Guinea. Flying 150 miles an hour with layovers and maintenance on the airplane and fuel problems, all that was very time-consuming back in the days of 1937.
How did that sort of thing work if you were flying around? Clearly it wasn't in one continuous. Would she just land and refuel and then go back up again? Or would she stop for a couple of weeks or a day or a month or something? I mean, how, you know, to fix the plane or like what's the logistics of that sort of journey?
Well, for instance, she started leaving the United States from Miami, Florida. She flew south down to South America. South America, the stays there were mostly overnight. In some cases, she stayed 1 or 2 days. And she was entertained at almost every stop. by the royalty, by the dignitaries of the cities where she stopped at, and she was invited out to dinner, and she was out to lunch, and the rest of the time she spent while they were working on the airplane. And those engines that she had on that airplane, 550 horsepower Pratt and Whitney Wasp engines, required a lot of maintenance. And I don't know why that was, but you see, 1937 was a little bit before my time. But that was in the days when aircraft engines were not that dependable. And they did require constant overhaul and constant maintenance and vast quantities of oil they consumed in addition to the gasoline. And there was even a problem of getting the gasoline to the stopover locations because it had to be carted in by truck in 50-gallon barrels, by the barrel.
Oh, God.
And, yeah.
Sounds pretty, yeah. So how far into the journey was she when she disappeared? Was it, you know, two-thirds, a quarter of the way? How close was she to finishing up the trip?
Oh, I would say she was 90% finished. When she was in Ley, New Guinea, which is just north of Australia, the next leg of the flight was from Ley to Howland Island, and that was considered the most dangerous part of the flight because the island was so small. But you have to realize she was a major in the Army Air Corps, and acting under orders from FDR and the Defense Department, they wanted to establish a route through the Pacific using Howland Island as a stopover and refueling point. So that was the purpose of using Howland. And it was a distance of about 2,500 miles, statute miles, or about 2,200 miles, nautical miles. And the flying time was about 20 hours, which they used something like 1,100 gallons of gasoline. I believe it was 87 octane. And there, however, she did have, I believe there was about 25 or 30 gallons of 100 octane on board when they left Ley, New Guinea. It was the most awkward part of the flight, and the flight where she made the grave mistake of not taking a radio operator, a qualified radio operator, on board the airplane. And that was the big problem with the loss of Amelia Earhart at Howland Island.
How so? What do you mean by that?
She did not, Amelia Earhart did not understand the radio systems. She did not understand Morse code. And from what I found out from Fred Gerner's files in Fredericksburg, she got all kinds of wrong information from her radio repairman.
Right. This is the new revelation that you told me about now earlier here, that you said to me in an email that you blame this Gerr character for her disappearance, in a sense, for the mission not going as planned, right?
That's right. Her repairman was Joseph Gerr. That's spelled G-U-R, and I call him Joseph Gerr with all more R's on the end. He told Amelia Earhart and preached to her that she could take direction-finding bearings on any frequency she wanted on her radio system. And it was completely in error. I mean, it was absolutely the wrong thing that anyone could have told Amelia Earhart, because the system she had for direction finding, that was a loop antenna system over the cabin of the airplane, would only work on low frequency. In this case, it was 500 kilocycles. And 500 kilocycles only functioned on Morse code. It was a Morse code station for ship-to-ship communications and emergency communications between airplanes. And she didn't understand Morse code. She couldn't read or send Morse code. and that may have been one reason why she objected to using it. But the big problem was that this Joseph Gurr told her that he had fixed her radios so that she could direction find with her loop antenna on high frequency, which is what she tried to do. She went to 3105 kilocycles, 6210 kilocycles, and 7500 kilocycles. That's way up the scale into high frequency, and she cannot take a bearing on high frequency with the radio equipment she had. It would not work. A loop antenna works on low frequency only. And it was really tragic because the solution to what happened there was so simple. All she had to do was switch her receiver over to low frequency, 500 kilocycles, and listen to the A's. A's are dit-da. Mm-hmm. The Itasca, which was the Coast Guard cutter that was on station, who was giving her a beam, a radio contact, was sending A's on low frequency, Morse code, on 500 kilocycles. That's way down the scale.
Yeah.
If she would have picked up those A's and used her loop antenna, she could have gotten a bearing right into the Itasca and Howland Island. That was the really tragic part of the whole thing. It just completely uncalled for.
Now, what do you think the reasoning was with this? Is this guy just mistaken? I mean, he didn't purposely mislead her, I presume.
Well, I don't think he did it purposely. I think the guy must have been a little bit screwy because just Fred Gurner taped an interview with her. Fred Gurner taped an interview with Joseph Gurr.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interview, he makes this statement that he brags about. He fixed the radios so she could direction find on all the frequencies. He never once realized that she could not direction find on low frequency with an RA1 radio system, which is what she had. And this is something that he couldn't fathom.
Interesting.
He couldn't understand it. But it was amazing because on the interview and the information that I got out of the files, Fred Gurner was the one, the radio reporter who was doing the interview, was the one who had to tell Joseph Gurr, the guy who's supposed to know so much about radios, that you cannot direction find a low frequency with a loop antenna. Yeah.
And what did Gurr say in the interview then? What was his response to that? He didn't believe him?
His response was, oh no, you mean you can't do that? That was his response, was, oh no. Isn't that odd? For the life of me, I couldn't understand what got into this guy.
That's just weird.
Telling her things like that.
That's just weird.
Yeah.
Oh God. Okay, so she's 90% done with the flight. She's en route to Howland Island. And so how does the, you know, it's almost impossible to really say how the disappearance happens, but, you know, take us through sort of those last final moments, as much as we actually know, you know, what happened.
Well, as she left Lake Ngene, she was in contact for about 5 or 6 hours, some say 8 hours, with Lay, almost in the vicinity of Nauru Island, which was pretty close to the halfway point to Howland. And she was broadcasting on 6210. The two aviation frequencies in high frequency were 3105 and 6210. One is the double of the other. They're called harmonic frequencies. And those were the two aviation frequencies of the day. And what happened was that she did not have the trailing antenna on the airplane. She took it off. And you cannot, over long distances, over open water, expect to communicate without that trailing antenna, which is like 250 feet long.
Oh, wow.
and it had a lead ball on the end. And when flying through the air, it was C-shaped. It would be almost not vertical, but close to a C-shape flying through the air. So you can imagine the length of, that's the equivalent of a 20-story building, 250 feet. That's what it took to communicate long distance over open water.
Oh my God, what a difference the world is now.
yeah, right.
Okay.
And this was 1937.
Yeah.
And the only thing she had to work with was the V antenna over the dorsal V over the cabin, V antenna over the cabin, and there was another V antenna on the fuselage below the cabin, which for the life of me, I can't understand. The radio people I've talked to can't understand why that thing was there. But it was supposed to increase the range. The truth of the matter is it didn't. And however, when she was talking back to Ley, New Guinea, it was on 6210. And 6210 is a higher frequency, and higher frequencies require shorter antennas. How about that? So 6210 would carry back to Ley, New Guinea all at the halfway point. But when she, at the halfway point, darkness fell and she switched to the nighttime frequency of 3105. In 3105, it was imperative to have that trailing antenna, and she didn't have it. And Joseph Gurr told her that he fixed the radios so she didn't have to have a trailing antenna. How about that for size?
Oh my God. This guy.
Yeah, he really fixed things.
He sure, yeah. So
he tells her that he modified the radio system. There was a coil, it's called a loading coil, inside the radio system that is necessary to broadcast and receive on low frequency and high frequency on vacuum tube radios. And the radios in those days were all operated on high powered voltage, on high frequency and low frequency. In order to run the vacuum tubes, it required high voltage. The problem with the frequencies was that when he put in this, he made a homemade loading coil and he wrapped extra wire around the loading coil. In other words, then he put this homemade loading coil back into the radio system, and the idea was that it was supposed to trick the radios into thinking that there was a 250 foot antenna trailing out the back of the plane. It was
right.
Supposed to be a trick for the radios. The only trouble is it didn't trick the radios. It didn't work. And what it did was it made the antennas extremely sensitive. Just the slightest movement in the antennas would throw them out of sequence and out of resonance, and you couldn't tell what she was saying.
Yeah.
How about that?
Pretty wild stuff. I mean, it's amazing that she was, like I said, it's a whole different world back then, but it's amazing that she's relying on some guy who's putting homemade crap in her plane to fly across the world. It's like I guess he was really, as professional as she could find, maybe. I don't know. I don't understand that. You know, why wasn't the Air Force helping out with this, or it just doesn't seem to add up that this remarkably unreliable and uninformed person was putting the pieces together on the plane.
She turned down help from Pan American World Airways, who flew those routes across the Pacific on a daily basis. She turned down help from the Navy, from the Army, from everyone. The only one
weird.
She listened to was Joseph Gurr. He was the one who sold her the bill of goods. She could do anything she wanted to, and she didn't have to have the trailing antenna. And she paid dearly for that price.
Absolutely.
And anyway, at the halfway point, darkness began to fall, and she switched from 6210 daytime frequency to 3105, which was the nighttime frequency. And 3105 requires a longer antenna than 6210. And because of the shortness of the antenna, the V antenna over the fuselage, there was very little contact between herself and the Tasca stationed offshore in Howland Island. And it was, as she flew in, the radio operators on the Itasca were completely baffled by her cutting in and cutting out and disappearing off the airways on 3105, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was super sensitive frequency that did require long antennas. And they could not take a bearing on her, and she could not take a bearing on them. She thought that the Itasca could direction find on high frequency, and she is sending whistling in the mic and talking and broadcasting on 7,500 kilocycles. That's even higher than 6210.
Yeah. So we're getting all this cross communication between her and the Itasca, no. And she can't see. So at this point, what's going on with the navigation instruments, though? I mean, does she really need to? Why does she need to talk to people out there? Is there a problem here with the navigation too?
Oh yeah, definitely. The Fred Noonan, her navigator, could shoot the stars late at night, and they were pretty much on course. In fact, if you plot it on the charts, you're going to see a direct line between Ley New Guinea and Howland Island. And the 20th hour, actually, earlier than that, the 18th hour, they started picking up her broadcasts on the Itasca, which meant that she flew a direct line.
Mm-hmm.
Because, the flying time and the distance covered wouldn't allow for any side trips. No spying activities in the Marshall Islands, no diversions, say to the island of Truk for spying activities or taking pictures. It just simply wasn't possible because the plane would have had to fly 400 miles an hour, 500 miles an hour to do that and keep the time schedule that she kept. The plane would cruise at 150 miles an hour, and 130 miles an hour, 130 nautical miles per hour. Most of the quotations you're going to see on distance and flying time and airspeed are in knots,
yeah.
Nautical miles per hour. There wasn't any question that she flew on a direct line, but when the sun came up, as they passed the Gilbert Islands, on the way into Howland, Fred Noonan would have been able to shoot the sun. So he had one bearing. And the one bearing he had was on the sun, which gave him longitude. In other words, distance east and west.
Right.
So he would know how far out they were. But the problem is that he didn't have latitude. He didn't have the second bearing, and it requires two bearings to establish a fix. He didn't have the second bearing, which would have given him latitude.
So there.
This is such a complicated. You want me to go into the more details? I can tell you more details about this.
I go there for it. I mean, let me make sure that I'm keeping pace with you, though.
Okay.
So their communication's completely out of whack. They went through the night, and now it's daytime, and they're still flying, and they're trying to figure out how to get to this Howland Island. And because it's daytime now, they have no means of navigation.
Well, sure. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and she was in daytime, and she was in the vicinity of Howland Island. But she was caught under a cloud formation to the north and west of Howland, and she couldn't find the Itasca. One of the problems she had was that loop antenna, and there was, at that time, Fred Hooven with Bendix Electronics, Bendix Radio, who had invented the automatic direction finder for low frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And he put that on her airplane. And she decided she didn't like it. But the truth of the matter is, she wanted the loop antenna because she thought that, well, that was the old established method, you know, and foolproof. She was afraid of newfangled ideas, evidently. But if she would have had Fred Hooven's automatic direction finder, it could have saved her life, because that direction finder would have given her a bearing on Jalawat Radio in the Marshall Islands. It would point, and it, not only that, but it was valid through static. It was valid through, you didn't have to have a high volume reception. It would pick up the radio station even on low volume, and it would automatically point directly to the station. See, one of the problems with the loop antenna was you would rotate the loop to find the null, the low point in the broadcast, and that would be pointing to the station. But there's another question, was it pointing to the station or away from the station? Was it to or from the station? You couldn't tell.
Yeah.
See,
it's a lot of, sounds like there's a lot of technical problems here with this.
And the automatic direction finder solved that problem. And Fred Noonan could have established the latitude of the airplane with an ATF, an automatic direction finder, but she took it off. She took it off. She took the whole system off the airplane and discarded it.
Why would she do that?
You're asking me. Well, it's the same reason she took off the trailing antenna. She just decided she didn't like it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I would have gotten in that. I would have flown in that airplane with Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, I would have taken the bus.
I'll say. She really had no idea of the danger she was facing.
Okay, so let's sort of let's move a little bit away here from the technical aspect of all this, because I can hear folks I can hear their eyelids drooping. So, at what point do they know that she's gone? You know, at what point is it like, oh no, she hasn't arrived yet? Is that kind of how they knew she was missing?
Well, the 20th hour was 8 o'clock in the morning, Howland time. On the Itasca was the time when she should have been over the Itasca and landing at Howland Island. And they waited until 12 o'clock that day before they declared her missing, because that was the time when they knew that she had exhausted her fuel supply. They instantly, when the search terminated, Thompson of the Itasca took off in the direction of those clouds. And the thing of it is, she was down to 1,000 feet, which is a terrible, when she called in the last few times to the Itasca, which is a terrible altitude to be flying over open water.
Yeah.
And she was forced down by the cloud formations to the north and west of the Itasca. They were convinced of that. And that's the direction they took. And undoubtedly most of the calculations I've seen, and they're in the book, Lost Flight. Roland Rennick did a good job calculating the time she had on that flying time she had on the airplane was in the vicinity of Howland Island. She had at least 4 and maybe 5 hours of flying time left on the airplane. And when she called in, she said she was low on fuel. And one of the radio operators accidentally wrote it down as only 30 minutes of gas left, which was completely an error. And the chief radio man, Leo Bellarts, on the Itasca, said it was an error. And what she said was she was low on fuel, and at that point, another 4 hours elapsed from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock, and they decided at that point she was out of fuel, and they declared her missing.
So they actually, it sounds like they didn't really go, they waited too long to go looking for her, is what you're intimating here,
well,
or suggesting.
As it turned out, it really didn't make that much difference.
Because ultimately, because of what you think ultimately happened, right, is what you're saying?
Yeah, ultimately, I think the radios in those days used, to power those vacuum tubes, used what's called a dynamotor. Dynamotor, D-Y-N-A motor, dynamotor, to boost the voltage off the generator and battery system to go into the radios to power up the vacuum tubes. And they had a lot of trouble with dynamotors. They would heat up, and some of them even caught on fire, and they could explode. And that's what I think happened. That's the only way we can explain it, really, that Amelia Earhart went completely off the airways, went blank for a period of about 3 or maybe 4 hours. No, I'd say 3 hours after she was last heard in the vicinity of the Itasca and Howland Island. Later the same day, there was a broadcast that was picked up by Nauru. That was Nauru Island. That was a halfway point where Earhart came on the airways with the transcription. She said, "Land ahead," which would put her in the vicinity of the Marshall Islands. Undoubtedly the Marshall Islands, but she didn't know if it was the Marshall Islands or the Gilbert Islands.
Right, right.
But they were close enough, right. You see, when Earhart was flying in to Howland, she passed over the Gilbert Islands, and these were chains of islands, and you're up at 7,000 or 8,000 feet. People who've flown that altitude in those areas have told me that the islands, the Gilbert Islands, will show up as a chain of an archipelago, a chain of islands.
Yeah.
And you can see them from one island to the next. And with that much knowledge, and they probably headed back to the Gilbert Islands. They thought they didn't realize how far north they were.
Yeah.
But and there's a reason for their being north. They headed back for the Gilbert Islands with the sun at their back, and that's another factor. See, when they were trying to find Howland and the Itasca, the sun was coming up right over the horizon and shining right in their face, and they had the visibility was cut down to practically nothing, zero. The bright sun, shining tropical sun at 1,000 feet. Shining right in your face, and you're trying to find islands on the surface of the ocean that look like dark spots from clouds.
Not an easy task. Not at all.
Not an easy task.
So they look for her. They can't find her, and then they just pretty much. How long did it go on? You know, at what point did we reach the point, kind of where we're at today, where it's the I wouldn't say the generally overall accepted belief that she crashed and sank, but it seems to be that's the one that the mainstream has fairly rested its laurels on.
Yeah, well, what we're trying to do with Lost Flight is introduce the Marshall Islands where we believe she crashed, and downplay this crashed and sank theory.
Right, right, but that's the one that, that they just...
We have proof. Just from the land ahead message, that 3 hours after Earhart had left the Howland area, the airplane was still flying. It was still flying. And later that night, there was another message that came in from the radio operator at Nauru Island, where he picked up the broadcast on Amelia Earhart broadcasts that sounded like the radio was out of tune, or she was holding the microphone too close to her lips and it was made a screeching noise. But he recognized the voice as being Amelia Earhart.
Now, how could that be possible if they were low on fuel? You mean like the plane would have been landed or crashed at that point, but they would have had access to the radio?
It crashed on an island somewhere out there in the Pacific, and the island was Millie Atoll, and I think we have proof of that now.
Okay. So we've taken a while here, but we've set the stage for the big disappearance and how it all went down. Now, you're pretty much saying that obviously you don't believe in the crashed and sank theory, especially because after all these years, we've never turned up any sign of the plane, you know, in the ocean or anywhere like that. Nothing ever came of it.
That's true, but that's coming to an end because we think we have an inspection plate off the airplane from Millie Atoll.
Right. I'm just.
I can send you a picture of it.
Please do send me the picture. I'll post it here on the website. So then, essentially, they said that it crashed and sank. There was no real, like, you know, it didn't really carry on from there, other than sort of the undercurrent discussion of what else could have happened beyond that. And that's where you come in as far as your perspective. Let's knock out some of the other ones. I guess let's sort of like knock out some of these other theories. The crashed and sank one is the obvious one that you're saying you just don't think it happened, especially because she was on the radio a couple times afterwards. How come? Are these disputed radio signals, or I mean, how come these aren't part of the overall narrative that, you know, the average person on the street knows?
Well, the problem is they've never been publicized. The people who know about these things, such as myself and the members of Lost Flight Group, which I work with, have never really publicized this. And we're attempting to publicize the messages from Nauru Island, the land ahead message, and the
muffled one.
The muffled one that followed later that night. And after the airplane crashed, the antennas had moved enough that they were completely out of resonance. The radio people call it resonance. What they're saying is you can't distinguish what the voice is saying over the telephone, because her transmissions were all in voice, with the exception of one transmission that Fred Noonan sent. They were all in voice. And there was a Navy captain, Almond Gray. The thing of it is that the transmissions didn't stop with just the two transmissions that were picked up by Nauru Island. There were transmissions that were picked up by Pan Am radio operators at Guam, at Midway, and at Honolulu. And they all heard the same screeching noise over the airways that they believe, if you follow it came from the eastern side of the Marshall Islands and then went down further south towards Gardner. Of course, everybody says, well, she went to Gardner. No, she didn't go to Gardner. Why would she try another isolated island like that when she couldn't find the one she was at?
Right.
With the sun in her face. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, okay, so we've dismissed the crash and sank, and we're talking about here these after radio signals. Now, you're touching on the Gardner Island. That's the big hope for a lot of people in the Amelia Earhart research community. You're talking about this, especially this Tiger group. They seem convinced that she crashed and survived on Gardner Island. So, I guess, talk about that theory, and you've already touched on why you don't think it's it's accurate, but, you know, extrapolate a little more on that and why, you know, why are they so convinced? If you're sure that that isn't what happened, why are they so sure that it is?
Well, that's how he makes his living, basically. His name is Gillespie, Rip Gillespie. None of the findings that he has found, none of them, absolutely none of them, have ever been traced to Amelia Earhart. And the place was populated and trampled down by radio sites during World War II, and explorers have been there. Natives have been there, and all the junk they left laying around. And World War II was, Howland Island was an active military installation. So you can just imagine the debris they left behind.
You mean Gardner Island?
You got Gardner Island, right. It was a military island. They were using it as a radio base. And, let's see, I had, they were using it. There's been so much traffic there that anything they found, anything that the Tiger Group has found, they can't trace it down. They can't trace down the bones. They can't trace down the sextant. And not only that, but it was a naval sextant. They didn't find the sextant. All they found was a box that looked like it contained a naval sextant. Well, the box for the naval sextant probably came from the wreck of the Norwich City on Garwin Island. There's so many ifs and buts. I mean, more recently, he said he had a picture of what he thought was the landing gear sticking up out of the water on the reefs off Gardner Island. And the only trouble is, this was in 1939, something like that. That picture was taken, and whatever it was, it isn't there now. And there is no way of proving that it ever came off the Earhart airplane, and which makes the type of evidence he likes to fool around with, because he doesn't have to prove it didn't come from the Earhart airplane. And then he finds wrinkle cream and freckle cream in a jar that could have contained Uncle Joe's freckle cream and whatever it was. And the jar they found was clear glass. And he puts up, Amelia Earhart had freckles, and she puts up on his website a picture of the freckle cream glass, and it's opaque. So what, I don't understand what goes on with him. I mean, they could have been, those jars could have been used for anything.
Yeah.
And none of his, that's on our website, by the way, the truth about Gardner Island at AmeliaEarhart.com.
Yeah.
www.lostflight.net. All of that is on the website, and it's all been disproved. None of it has ever made any sense.
Interesting, because all you ever see, it's now we're going to get to your theory now in a moment, because I find it not only the most fascinating, but also the most just really jaw-dropping and intriguing. And it's certainly not one that hasn't been put out there before. It's been around for a while, but you really dug into it. But it's disappointing to hear you say this stuff about the Gardner Island thing, because... And I'm sure it probably makes you want to just pull your hair out, because every news story I see on Amelia Earhart nowadays, which is scant in and of itself, is about this Gardner Island theory and how they're looking at Gardner Island all the time. And I'm always hearing sort of these tantalizing little bits of possible stuff found at Gardner Island. And you're just saying, forget all that. It's not adding up.
Well, just to give you an idea of how desperate they are for evidence, they went around picking up dried up feces off the beach thinking it was Amelia Earhart's.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine that?
What, 75-year-old poop?
75-year-old poop. Unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Sitting there on an island in the wind and the rain and the storms and the hurricanes, and he thinks it's belongs probably some dog or something.
Oh, goodness, that's just
unbelievable.
Okay, so your thoughts here on all this is that she ended up in the Marshall Islands, Millie Atoll, Roy Namur, I'm sure I mispronounced that. And
oh, no, Roy Namur, that's it.
Oh,
Roy
great.
Namur, okay, Marshall Islands.
Let me just set you up here so you can I can wind you up and let you go. And that they crashed on at the Marshall Islands and then subsequently fell into the hands of the Japanese. That's sort of the theory that you're putting forward here. And as I said, this isn't some new, you didn't come up with this on your own. I mean, how long have people been suggesting that idea that she was captured by the Japanese? Because I remember hearing it a while ago.
Well, I can't really say when it started.
It's probably just always been around.
Yeah, I think Fred Gerner may be the one who really started it. There has been books written. Randall Brink has a book. There's been several books written about the Marshall Islands, but they never have really gotten the publicity. And I think this much, that we've, with the inspection plate that we found in the Marshalls, in the interviews that Dick Spink did in the Marshalls, I think it's going to convince a lot of people because we can put that on television.
Mm.
So for the first time, and the newspapers, we can do a press release on that, on the newspapers, in addition to television. And I think it will get the publicity it deserves. Because it completely nullifies Gardner Island. Gardner Island is just a sad state of affairs. Now, of course, I have to admit that Gillespie and the Tiger Group in particular have done a lot of work on their research, and they spent a lot of time on it, but it is pointless. It doesn't lead anywhere, and no one has ever stated at any time that this came from Amelia Earhart. The DNA evidence they tried to track down with the feces and all the rest of it, it's all just so much hype. Hot air, that's all it is.
Yeah. So what makes you...
But they got the publicity, that's the whole point. So.
Exactly. For some folks, that's all that matters. Take us through what you've got here as far as evidence and speculation and whatnot and witness testimony that strengthens this case that they crashed in the Marshall Islands and then were captured by the Japanese.
Okay, well, there is the stories from the Marshall Islands is that there was a fisherman at Millie Atoll who was out fishing one day in 1937. And he looked up, and an airplane came circling overhead and crashed on one of the reefs. And when Dick Spink was there, he tried to interview the man, but he was on vacation or something. I don't know what happened. He couldn't get his interview, but he got the interviews from... a lot of the notables from the Marshall Islands, for instance, a senator, the president of the Marshall Islands, King Amato of the Marshall Islands, and it's not much of a secret in the Marshall Islands, if you talk to the people who live there.
Yeah.
That Amelia Earhart crashed on Millie Atoll. And in the film that Dick shot, he shot the actual landing spot where they were told. They told where the airplane crashed. And from there they were taken prisoners by the Japanese. And Japanese in 1937 were in a war where had their bayonets on the ends of their rifles. It was really a war scenario is what it was.
Now, that confused me a little bit because this was 1937. It's 4 years before Pearl Harbor. She's an international celebrity. I mean, I'm just surprised that they would take her and imprison her and it wouldn't get out at all at the time. I guess, obviously, I'm thinking of a world with, 24/7 media and Twitter and all that. That some, I'm expecting a guard to tweet that they captured her. But you know, it's amazing to me. I guess you could say that here they are. They're not at war with the United States yet. They're 4 years away from that. Yet they still believe that Amelia Earhart and Noonan, Fred Noonan, were spies, and then they take them into captivity?
That's right, captivity. From the Marshall Islands, they believe they were taken to the islands of Roy Namur. From Roy Namur, they were flown by seaplane to Saipan, where they were imprisoned and they were executed. And in the film that Dick Spink ran, they've got pictures of Millie Atoll from the air, which are very good. And the condition of the atoll, he says that when the airplane crashed, the atoll was so rough with the coral sticking up, and you see pictures of it, that it not only caved in the left wheel, but it tore the left wing off the airplane. And this is where the inspection plate came from, we believe. And we're in the process now of proving that inspection plate came off an L-10, a Lockheed Electra Model 10E. That's what we're attempting to prove right now. We have to find, well, we know where the 10Es are, and we're trying to get pictures of that inspection plate.
Now, would the inspection plate, does it contain any sort of signature?
Red paint.
What's that?
Red paint.
Well, I guess I was going to say, does it contain any absolute sort of signature, maybe a serial number? I don't even know an inspection plate is, but I'm just saying, is it something that you can categorically take and say, this was absolutely on the plane because it has this number on it or anything like that? Or is it, or are we going to run into skeptics who are going to dismiss it as something that you found at a junkyard or something?
This is something that would be only off an airplane. The red paint would have to be, you see the leading edges of the wing and the tail section were painted with red paint, and the inspection plate has red paint on it.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's the correct type of aluminum that was used in World War II by Lockheed. We know that much. And all we need now, really, is pictures of the inspection plate on the airplane.
Right. So go ahead.
Yeah, I think that would probably be the tie-down factor.
Yeah.
I'll send you pictures of the inspection plate.
Yes, send me the pictures, absolutely. I guess what I'm saying is this isn't something that I could go on eBay and get, or, you know, a plane aficionado wouldn't be able to get his hands on for me or something like that, right? I mean, and it was found at the Marshall Islands?
Oh, yes, it was found on Millie Atoll. The plate is about 4 inches long and about 2 inches wide, or 2.5 inches wide.
And how did they find it? Did someone have it as a memento of some kind? Or?
No, it was laying on the ground. It was laying in a debris field with aluminum. With the aluminum scattered around. I told Dick that he should have picked up the aluminum that was scattered around the plate. See, when they tore the airplane, when the wing was torn off the airplane, it might have torn off the inspection plate at the same time, and nobody paid any attention to it. It's been laying there all those years. It looks like a piece of metal, aluminum, with some red paint on one end that has been laying out in the weather and the wind and the rain for 76 years. That's what it looks like.
So you're saying there was still a debris field from the crash even after all these years?
Well, he did find more debris. He found a door latch mechanism that his maintenance man he knows in Washington, he's from Bow, Washington, said that those were parts off an aircraft door, off the door of an airplane. So as soon as we get this tracked down as to the plate, the next thing we want to track down is the parts from the door that came off an airplane. He did find that, and he also found an upholstery button lying on the ground, but I don't have much faith in that, but the door part sounds doable.
Yeah, that sounds like something that could really help.
This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries we will examine.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The early morning of July 2nd, 1937. Amelia Earhart and her navigator are bound westward over the lonely mid-Pacific. It is the final leg of a grueling round-the-world flight. Within several hours, they will disappear.